following is a paid program. The opinions contained within do not necessarily reflect those of the staff, management, or sponsors of News Talk Radio WOBM AM 1160 and 1310.
Inside the Law is presented to educate listeners in Monmouth and Ocean counties about legal issues. The opinions expressed by the host, guests, and phone callers are strictly their own and do not necessarily reflect those of Town Square Media and are not intended to be a substitute for personal legal advice from your own attorney.
Your questions and comments are welcome at 732-505-1160. Inside the Law, talk radio for the Jersey Shore.
Good morning, Monmouth and Ocean counties, and good morning to the rest of the world that's listening to us out there on the internet. This is Jason Wyatt, your host today from the law firm Novi & Associates, and we are hosting Inside the Law on 1160 WOBM AM and 1310 AM in Ocean County. Novi & Associates is a boutique law firm here in Monmouth and Ocean County, specializing in elder law, trust and estate planning, asset protection, Medicaid planning, and guardianship. We have a great show for you this morning, so hopefully everybody's out there enjoying the morning but has their radio tuned in so they can hear about today's topic, which is Senior Scams Part 2. On our last show, 2 weeks ago, attorney Bob Novi from Novi & Associates had on Ocean County Prosecutor Joe Coronado to talk about this same topic from a law enforcement standpoint. And today we have on Barbara Baldwin from Ocean First Bank, where she is a senior vice president and retail operations manager for the bank, to talk about that same topic from a bank perspective. Good morning, Barbara.
Good morning, Jason, and good morning, everyone.
I'm excited about today's topic because it's a topic that we hear a lot about and get a lot of questions on, quite frankly, in our office. Our practice area at Novi & Associates is very much senior-focused not by design, but just by default because of what we do. People tend to be more motivated to do estate planning once they're over the age of 50 or 60. And we do get a lot of questions because so many of our clients are seniors about senior scams, about protecting a lot of times their parents, you know, who might be in their 80s or 90s. Things like that. So I'm excited to chat with and interview you today, Barbara. Today is a live show, so if anybody out there has a question related to our topic in any way, shape, or form, please do not hesitate to give us a call. The call-in number is 732-505-1160. That's 732-505-1160. We also have a number of ways that you can get in touch off the air if, sometimes calling into a radio show can be a little daunting, but don't let that dissuade you. But if you'd rather write us your question or talk to us off the air, there's going to be a number of ways that I'm going to detail throughout the show that you can get in touch with us during the week for both myself and for Barbara. So I want to just introduce Barbara. I know I introduced your title at the bank, Barbara, but you have a pretty impressive track record, let's say, in the banking industry. So you've been in the banking for over 30 years, right?
That's correct.
Okay. And you've been, it looks like you've had experience in all sorts of different areas of basically of running a bank, bank operations, bank systems, bank security, mergers and acquisitions. Currently, Barbara is in the retail operations side, including branch procedures, which I'm sure brings you into contact with senior scams and information about that from time to time. And, of course, I always like to plug that Barbara is a lifetime resident of Monmouth and Ocean counties. So, Barbara, just from a starting perspective, the world of senior scams, how does that come into play in your day-to-day life? What aspect of your job at the bank has you dealing with senior fraud and senior financial abuse and things like that?
Well, I also serve as the bank's bank secrecy officer and mm-hmm. security officer. So those roles are typically where I see the senior fraud.
Okay. And is it something that you see directly, or do you have bank employees that tip you off and bring you in?
It's actually both.
Okay.
We may have reports come in from the branches. Law enforcement may call us regarding something that they've become aware of.
Okay. And when they do that, how do they know what senior financial abuse is? What is the definition that you guys try to work with to not only, I mean, if you need to spot a bald eagle, you have to be able to say what a bald eagle looks like, right?
Right?
So if you have to spot senior financial abuse or a senior scam, you have to be able to say what it looks like or be able to define it. So what do you use as a definition?
Well, if you go by the definition that the National Center of Elder Abuse uses, they call it the illegal or improper use of an older adult's funds, property, or assets. And the National Adult Protective Services further defines it as the misuse, mishandling, or exploitation of property, possessions, or assets without the consent, under false pretense, or through coercion or manipulation.
Okay. So similar definitions, but both basically pointing at the same concept. So, and I want to clarify for our audience, we hear about senior scams, senior financial abuse. Today's show is not centered on senior physical abuse, which is a whole different type of senior abuse. What we're really talking about, and what Barbara pointed out with those definitions, is that we're talking about financial abuse. This is, you know, the stuff that you hear about on Dateline or 60 Minutes, the scam artists that exist out there. And there are scam artists out there that target every segment of the population. But we hear a lot about internet scam artists that are focused at teens and children on the one end of the scale, the people that might be a little bit vulnerable. And today's topic is on the other end of the scale, financial and scam artist type abuse on the focused on people over the age of what age do you guys define a senior as? 65?
I think depending.
Okay.
The definition varies.
Loose definition.
55 and over, let's say.
Okay, 55 and over. So, I mean, the starting point is if you know what senior financial abuse is, or at least if you understand the definition, the next question I have is, well, when you see it, what are give me some examples. What are the types of things that you see? And maybe I'm really interested in who do you see committing the crime or the scam, carrying it out?
That's a very good question, Jason, and we see a variety of things. Financial abuse can be committed by friends and family members, caregivers, scam artists, as you already mentioned,
mm-hmm.
financial advisors, mm-hmm. bankers, attorneys.
No, never
yes.
attorney.
A power of attorney or guardian.
Sure.
Home repair contractors, a variety of.
So it's kind of a long list, but I think that one thing I like to focus on there in your answer is that the first thing you said was family members, and that's probably, in my opinion, when we hear it from our clients, the saddest, not that any senior financial abuse is lacks, you know, sadness, but the most sad circumstances usually are when it is in fact a family member, a loved one taking advantage of a senior, and it does happen frequently. So I think we're gonna talk about that a little more before our hour is up, but you know, some of the other people on that list I think are interesting because you put people in a position where you feel like you can trust them by virtue of a professional relationship, whether that means it's your longtime handyman or plumber who comes in and out of your house and you think of as, you know, the same way you think of your hairdresser or your barber, somebody that you know really well. And, yeah, you pay them for their services, but they seem almost like a friend. To an attorney or an accountant or a financial advisor, you know, somebody that you have probably, you know, paid a you know, nice amount of money to from a fee standpoint to give you professional services over the years. And you still have to be wary as a senior or as a loved one of a senior that these people might not have the best interests of their client or of their customer at heart. So, you know, that answer, and I had a feeling what you were going to say, Barbara, because I've heard, you know, lists have been and stats before. Thank you, Lauren. I've heard stats before that the most likely person to commit senior financial abuse is usually a family member. But I also like to point out that attorneys and bankers and accountants and financial advisors. Nobody's exempt. There are certainly every day, every year, you know, lawyers in New Jersey who get disbarred for what they do with senior funds or what they've done with senior clients. There are bankers who lose their license. So this is the point I want to make. I think we do have our first call today. Lauren, who do we have? Good morning, Victoria. How are you?
Good morning. I'm well. How are you?
Very well. You have a question for us this morning?
Yes. I wanted to know, I'm currently 30 years old, and I wanted to know if it was in my best interest to have a will form because I have two young children.
Sure. I can answer that question for you. The most common life event that winds up with people coming in to do a will for the first time is, in fact, having children. And the reason for that is that if something happens to you, God forbid, at a young age, your children wouldn't have necessarily an automatic guardian, depending on what the situation was with their other parent. But the other thing that happens is that even if the family is all living together and both parents still have their parental rights, when you have younger people passing away early, and here I mean the parents, people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s, you very often see that happening in pairs, car accidents being by far the most common. So whether you're single or whether you're still together with a parent and whether you all have parental rights or not, a will is very important for the simple reason that if something happened to one or both of the people who have legal guardianship for those children, the will is the spot where you can appoint who you would like to have serve if you couldn't serve. A lot of us have, you know, kind of informal godparents that we name for our children. You know, this, that my sister, my brother, my cousin, my aunt, whoever it is. Mm-hmm. Sometimes it's your parents themselves who are designated to be the people that take care of or oversee or are in charge of spiritual guidance, but they don't have a legal right to raise children, to raise them in their house and so forth. So certainly in your 30s, if you have children, Victoria, is there's no reason not to come in and have a will. Another reason, and it's kind of a little kind of a side note that people don't realize, is that when you pass away, whether you have a will or not, in order for the person in charge of the estate, which is called an executor if you have a will, or if you don't have a will, it's called an administrator. But in order for them to do anything on behalf of the estate, you know, pay your final bills, file your final tax return, change the title on bank accounts or real estate that you own so that it can go into the hands of the kids or into trust for them or into custodial accounts for them and so forth, that person, that adult who's serving in that capacity, has to be appointed by the surrogates court in New Jersey, which is what we call our probate court. And in order to get appointed, they have to process some paperwork with the courthouse. And that paperwork, if you don't have a will, carries the requirement that they have to post something called a surety bond. It's kind of like an insurance policy to make sure that if they mess up, that there's an insurance policy that will pay out to the kids what they should have received had the administrator or executor not messed it up. The reason I mention it is that when you buy insurance, there's always a cost that you're paying a company for. Like when we buy car insurance, we pay our premium in case we have an accident. And for most people, they want to, A, control who the person is that's going to be in charge of their estate. You know, usually people name their spouse if they're married, and if they're not married, they name somebody else in the family. And if they don't have anybody in the family they can trust, they might name a lawyer or a bank. But like Ocean First, and I'll plug Ocean First Trust Company, which is a very, very well-run and reputable trust company. But if you're going to take the time and think about who you want to be in charge, the other advantage that comes with naming that person in a will is that we can write as the attorneys that they do not have to post a bond. So the kicker in the long run is that if you have a will and you had to pay money for it, that provision in the will that says they don't have to post a bond will actually wind up paying for the will itself and then some. In other words, the bond that you have to post if you don't have a will is more expensive than the cost of preparing a will 99% of the time. So there's no reason not to have a will. And if you have little kids, you know, having a guardian named in there is very, very important, even if you don't have substantial assets yet. And when you sign a will in your 30s, Victoria, you can always come back in your 40s and your 50s and your 60s and redo it as circumstances change, as children age and so forth. But it's never too early, especially once you have kids.
Oh, well, thank you so much for your advice.
Okay.
Take care. I love you a lot. Thank you.
Thanks for the call. Thanks for listening.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Have a good one. So that was a little off topic, but a great question actually from Victoria. So I wanted to take it and answer it. Sorry, Barbara. Thank you for indulging me. So we were talking about who typically commits financial abuse and, and focusing on the fact that not only is it professionals, but also most of the time family members. But really, to me, it brings up the question of, well, if family members commit financial abuse, you know, how do they get away with it? What is it about seniors that makes them vulnerable to exploitation from a family member or from a trusted advisor or even, you know, from a stranger, telemarketer, or emailer or something like that? Barbara, what do you think?
Well, older adults are generally very attractive targets. They're available because many of them are retired.
Mm-hmm. They have the time.
So, right. They have the time. They're at home. They're able to read their mail.
Mm-hmm.
They're able to answer the phone, use the internet. And they're more likely to have significant assets or equity in their homes or both. So
sure.
People over 50 actually control about 70% of the nation's wealth.
Sure.
So they're also less likely to report
right.
the abuse.
They've, you know, and we work with a lot of good financial advisors in our business, you know, that are trying to make sure that their clients and customers' estate plans are in place, so they refer business to us, and we also refer business to them when we see a client that is asking for help, or sometimes they wind up asking their lawyer for financial advice, and I don't know, you know, bubkis about stocks or bonds, and I'm not a financial professional. But one thing that we hear from them is that, you know, when you're working, you're going through what they call the accumulation phase. You're accumulating your assets and building them up. And then at some point you decide, I'm ready to retire. And so when you first retire, especially in that first decade or two, that's going to be the high point of your net worth for most people throughout your lifetime. And so Barbara's point is extremely well taken, that not only do seniors have their home basically to become victims of the fraud, so to speak. They have the time. They are a voice on the other end of the phone or on the other end of the computer or what have you. But they also have the assets to be targeted, whereas a person in their 20s or 30s might be working full time. They're not at home. They can't answer calls. They can't participate in the fraud. It's like if you're the fraudster and you're going fishing, that pond has no fish in it if all the fish are at the office. So that you don't have that problem with the seniors. And then with the 20 and 30 and 40-year-olds, a lot of times they haven't accumulated much yet. They're still working to build their nest egg. And even if they, you know, if they own their own home, there's not that much equity. And if they have a 401k or an IRA, it's still pretty small. They're still contributing to it. They're raising their kids. They're putting them through college. They don't have the bullseye on their back the way the seniors do. And what was the percentage, Barbara? Is 70% of
50% of people or people over 50
uh-huh.
control 70% of the nation's wealth.
Okay, and I hadn't heard that stat before, but that's pretty. I mean, I think that shows how powerful that the retired community is when it comes to control of assets. So no wonder they're the target of scam artists and financial abuse. They're the ones holding the dollars, and it's just natural that they would have that bullseye on their back. So I've never heard the numbers that stark, but that's a pretty good explanation, not only why they're vulnerable, but why they're targeted as well. Lauren, I think we have another call. Good morning, Gina. How are you?
Good morning. I'd like to ask a question of Barbara.
Certainly.
Could you tell me, if someone has a power of attorney and they come into the bank, do they verify that the person is a true power of attorney? Do they call the person whose money is in the bank, or do they just take it for face value? How does that work?
Well, typically what happens is the person whose account on which the power of attorney exists has provided the bank with that power of attorney. So that's given normally in advance.
Oh, okay. You just can't really walk in and say I'm the power of attorney.
Typically not.
And Barbara, and I'm going to expound on that question, Gina. If they did that, if they walked in and they had an original power of attorney with a raised seal, is that something that they might eventually be able to use, but that the bank has procedures in place to verify the authenticity of it? And
yes,
to,
correct.
Okay. And does that answer your question, Gina, that the best way to do it, and I tell this to my clients too, and it's a very good question, if you have a power of attorney in place and you think that you might be giving the person who you've named as the agent or attorney, in fact, you know, duties, you want them to do banking on your behalf and so forth, I tell them, bring it to the bank and have it registered with the bank, have them review it. I assume you guys maybe put it in the system somehow, scan it or something like that.
We do. We keep it on file.
So they keep it a copy on file. And that's always the best way to do it. Failing that, I tell them if you ever have to use it someplace where you haven't pre-registered it, you're going to face some hurdles to jump over. You'll probably be able to get over them as long as it's not a fraudulent sort of situation.
Right.
But it's going to be a little bit tougher because the banks have to do their due diligence. They want to protect their clients and make sure that, you know, a fraudster, for example, can't just walk in with a piece of paper and start withdrawing funds from somebody's account.
That's correct.
Does that answer your question, Gina?
Yes, it does. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Thanks for calling.
Yeah, thanks for listening, and thanks for the call. Another good question this morning. So if we know that seniors are often taken advantage of, and we know why, because they're natural targets in a lot of ways, considering the accumulated wealth that they are basically sitting on, whether that be in the form of, you know, people hear the word wealth and they say, oh, I'm not wealthy. But the point is that the equity in your house is a form of wealth, retirement assets that you don't really touch other than required minimum distributions in the eyes of a scam artist is still, you know, a pillow full of, you know, a pillowcase full of cash in a lot of ways. So and I know also, let me say this, I know a lot of seniors out there do keep too much, in my opinion, too much cash and valuables in their house. Please, 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 if nothing else today, if you're one of those seniors that has a substantial amount of cash in your house, and I would say anything over a couple $1,000s, you know, God forbid it be $5,000, $10,000, or $100,000, and I've seen that. And the same goes for valuables. I've seen seniors that load their house with extremely valuable items, Ladro and Hummel dolls and jewelry, of course, and things like that. Two things. Number one, make use of a bank. We have FDIC insurance. What's the FDIC insurance maximum today, Barbara?
I think it's at $250.
$250, now. Which is bigger than it was, you know, a decade ago. And make use of safety deposit boxes. You know, if you have valuable jewelry and so forth, because as people age, we talked, and Barbara gave an answer where she cited not only family members and professionals, but also handymen and service professionals that are coming
such
in.
As caregivers.
Caregivers is a big one.
Yes, it is.
People that are in the house for multiple hours at a time, sometimes 24/7, if the person's care warrants it. You know, that's way too much money to have there. That's you're putting yourself in a very, very risky situation. That's like, you know, putting on an Ohio State jersey and walking into the middle of Michigan Stadium after a big Ohio State loss. You've got a big target on your back if you put yourself in that situation. So please reconsider that and make use of, you know, a bank like Ocean First that has, you know, a lot of different types of accounts to offer if you want to deposit cash, as well as, you know, a traditional safety deposit box. And
correct.
I imagine you have them of all different sizes.
Yes, all different sizes,
yeah, so,
all different prices.
So definitely look into that. So this is the big question that I want to ask. What are some of the types of scams that you guys see in the banking world that are perpetrated against seniors? And how do they do it? Is it a phone call? Is it an email? Is it in person? Give me a couple of examples. Give me some idea of what you do see out there on the front lines every day, Barbara.
So the communication channels that are used include the telephone.
Sure.
You know, regular mail, email, the internet, in person. That's the oldest way of performing a scam, and it's still out there. So we see a variety of scams. We see internet scams, certainly mail scams involving lottery and sweepstakes.
Mm-hmm.
So you might get a letter indicating that you've won the lottery, a sweepstakes, a contest, something like that. You're instructed to wire the money to pay for taxes or processing fees before mm-hmm. you receive the prize. And then obviously there really is no prize and you're stuck with that loss of money.
Right.
There are grandparent scams where someone knows that this individual may have a grandchild or be of the age where they would have a grandchild. They call them, tell them that I'm in trouble.
Mm-hmm.
They sound plausibly like the grandchild.
Right.
And they need money quickly, or someone else calls and says, I'm calling for your grandchild.
Right.
You need to send money quickly. They're in trouble. And people fall for that. We have people who sell items on the internet,
right.
Craigslist or eBay.
Sure.
They might get a check that's for more than the sale price of the item.
Mm-hmm.
And they're told, oh, my bank made a mistake. Please send me the difference. So you deposit the item, and mm-hmm. then you find out the entire item is a fraud.
Right.
And you're out not only possibly your merchandise, which has already been picked up.
Sure.
But you're also out the money that you sent them, and then the entire check is bad. So if you've withdrawn more than that.
Right. So you give away an item,
right.
and then you give them their change back, basically.
Right.
And the change is off of a check that eventually winds up being from bad funds anyway. And so
exactly.
you basically gave them an item and change, and you got nothing in return.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Okay.
There are relationship scams. So mm-hmm. a lot of seniors may be lonely, and they're looking for a love relationship or a good friend.
Mm-hmm.
And they meet someone who, over time, asks for help financially.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it may be in person.
Mm-hmm.
It may also be over the internet. And then it happens possibly repeated times, and the senior finally realizes that they've been taken advantage of, that this is not a true relationship, but one that was established only for financial gain by that other person.
Sure.
Okay. There are mystery shopper scams. So a lot of times we see that someone will get a letter in the mail with instructions to do with the check,
mm-hmm.
and they deposit it, and it comes back that it's not a valid item.
Sure.
Either. So there are a variety of ways that we see scams being perpetrated.
Yeah. One of those really rung a bell, the relationship scams. Mr. Novi tells a story about a case where a second marriage couple in one of the senior communities got married later, during retirement, so to speak. And the wife had children from a prior adult children from a prior marriage where she had lost her husband. When they did their estate plan, they decided not to take any advice on kind of second marriage planning that we do, you know, where somebody wants to make sure that when they die, even though they love their second or third or fourth spouse, that they kind of say, well, you leave yours to your kids, I leave mine to mine kids. And they decided not to do that. They didn't feel like it was enough money to justify it, although it was a substantial estate, in my opinion. And then the wife wound up dying, and her kids wound up trying to take their stepfather to court so that he couldn't claim a share of or all of her estate. And they lost. The stepfather won. But the key fact to this case is that when the wife died, she was 84, and the stepfather, the husband, was 29. And that's, I think, an extreme example of relationship fraud.
Yes.
But you know, he created the relationship solely for the purpose of, you know, trying to get his hands on her estate, and was successful, and legally successful in the long run. That's a very hard type of fraud to prosecute. Because it's a little bit different than, you know, the eBay fraud that you made as an example and so forth. But it does happen and it does exist. And the kicker to that story was that he was mad that he had to sell the house that she owned after she died, because it was in an age restricted community and he wasn't old enough, He didn't want to have to move because probably he wanted to make friends with the little old lady next door and repeat the scam. So anyway, that's a very good point that relationship scams are common. You know, you feel like somebody is there, is your friend, is, you know, like a son or like a cousin. You meet them at church or you meet them in some sort of social setting, and it turns out that all they're doing is trying to build a relationship with you and then use that relationship as a way to pull on your heartstrings to have you give them money for what probably they usually say is an emergency or a one-time thing, but then it happens over and over again.
It happens over and over again, or it might be for a large purchase.
Right, right, right.
Depending on the circumstances. So we also
help with the house, help with the car.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And we also see ways that are common in terms of how family members and trusted others might exploit seniors by using a power of attorney. Mm-hmm. We've talked about that. That's a way. Even though it's a valid power of attorney, the person who possesses that power of attorney may be using it for more than it was intended.
Correct. And
to get monies of their for themselves.
Let me pause and talk about that, because people, you know, they a lot of misconceptions out there about powers of attorney. And I tell my clients that when you sign a power of attorney, which is a document wherein you appoint somebody else to be able to carry out business basically on your behalf, including banking transactions, including signing contracts to purchase things, to sell things, and so forth, taking out loans, you're giving them a lot of power. And you got to think very hard about who you name, because it is a position of trust that you're placing them in. But it's not a license to steal. And I think that's what you mean, Barbara.
Right. You need to consider the fiduciary power that you've been given as a result of that.
Correct. When a person is named under a power of attorney, they do not have the right to use the bank account of the person who gave them the power of attorney like it was their own bank account. They have a fiduciary duty to the person who gave them the power to act on their behalf for their benefit. It is not a license to steal. It is not a license to take that money and buy their own clothes or go to Atlantic City or buy a car with it. And a lot of people get in hot water, even if they're not quite that, you know, they don't have that much bad intent. They get in hot water when they start doing things like, oh, well, I'm going to pay myself back for the 6 hours that I spent, you know, doing XYZ for my grandma or for my aunt or whatever, for my mom, for my dad, you know, because that's very difficult to justify as a fiduciary expense. That's very different than if you, you know, you pay for somebody's car to be repaired and you're paying a payment for their car directly to their mechanic. So I just want to make sure everybody understands that a power of attorney is not giving money to somebody. It's not giving them the right to use the money for whatever they want. If the person who gave them the power is capacitated, then really that person who is acting under the power of attorney, they should be checking with the power giver at every step of the way. Do you want me to pay this bill? Do you want me to take out this money? They should basically have authorization, if not written, at least verbal, for every financial transaction they enter into on behalf of that person. It's not a license to steal, and they are used that way. You know, I compare it to buying a car for somebody versus giving them the keys. You know, if I want to buy you a car, I'm going to buy you a car. If I say, here's a copy of the keys for my car so you can drive me places, that doesn't mean that I just gave you the car. And that's the difference between giving somebody money and giving them a power of attorney, in my opinion.
Sometimes we also see people taking advantage of joint checking accounts. So a parent may have a child on an account.
Right.
They might take money for themselves in the same way they might misuse the power of attorney to pay their own bills. They might, in some instances, refuse medical care that a senior might need. Keep the change from errands. And it's sad because some of this is done because people tend to believe that, oh, I'll inherit this eventually anyway.
Right. So
why not get it now?
Right.
But that's the wrong attitude.
Correct.
To have.
And I just want to remind everybody that you're listening to Inside the Law today on 1160 WOBM AM in Ocean County and 1310 AM in Monmouth County. I'm attorney Jason Wyatt, your host. And we are in part two of our Senior Scams shows talking to Barbara Baldwin, Senior Vice President and Retail Operations Manager for Ocean First Bank. If you have any questions, we are a live show today. 732-505-1160 is the number. Again, it's 732-505-1160. And we've had a couple of good calls this morning. But if you have questions that you don't feel comfortable asking on the air or that you'd like to ask either Barbara or myself during the week, there's a couple of ways to get in touch with us. First of all, that you can call us at Novi & Associates, which is the law firm where I work during the week. The phone number there is 732-657-0600. And we have locations in Seagirt and in Manchester, New Jersey, in Monmouth and Ocean County. We also have a website that contains a wealth of information, including today's show. Eventually will be posted on the website so you could re-listen to it and past shows as well. We have an archive of our shows. Great way to get, you know, free legal advice, so to speak, or at least get some background in these areas, is to listen to those shows. And that's www.novilaw.com. That's NOVYLAW.com. And I encourage you to check that out or shoot us an email at info@novilaw.com. Any of those ways work. We do once in a while still get a traditional, snail mail question. So I encourage you to send those snail mail questions in as well. And especially if you have a question that you want us to answer on the air during a future show, we actually try to encourage people to send those questions in one way, shape, or form. If we answer your question on the show, after you send it in, we'll send you a gift certificate to one of the local area restaurants so you can have dinner on us, because we want to encourage people to do that. Barbara, if anybody has, you know, a question for you during the week, what is the best way to get in touch if they don't want to call in today?
They can reach me at 732-240-4500, okay, which is the main number. I'm at the Ocean First headquarters at 975 Hooper Avenue.
Okay.
And they can ask for me, or you can email me at bbaldwin@oceanfirst.com.
So I encourage people to use those modes of communication. Because, this is a sensitive area, especially if you think you've been the victim or you think you have a loved one who might have been the victim of a senior financial abuse or a senior scam. You may not want to share it with the world, but you may want to get some advice on what the next steps are. So use those modes of communication to get in touch. I just want to kind of say a few words about Barbara's last comment when it comes to joint accounts. I'm a big opponent of joint accounts with children. I firmly believe that most people use them out of convenience sake, and they're really replacing they're coming up with a less good solution to a problem that should be solved with a power of attorney. And a power of attorney document carries with it what we talked about as we, you know, when we were before I was plugging the email address and so forth, which is that there's a fiduciary relationship between an agent and the person who gives them power under power of attorney, which is to say it's not a license to steal. There's some safeguards that come with the power of attorney, such as the fact that a bank will look into does this person really have authority? Have we reviewed this power of attorney before? They'll do homework. When you name a person as a joint account holder, you're giving them, in my opinion, you are almost giving them a license to steal. They have as much right to withdraw money from that account as you do.
Yes.
And really to use it for anything that they want. And so people will throw their kids' names, so to speak, onto their accounts without thinking about it and without thinking about the ramifications. And there's a whole slew of other reasons which are probably beyond the scope of today's show that it's a bad idea, not, you know, above and beyond just the fact that you're giving them too much access and there's no safeguards or hurdles put in place for what they can use it for. And those include estate and inheritance tax implications, especially if, God forbid, the child dies before the parent. Mm-hmm. or not necessarily a child, could be a niece, could be a nephew, could be a cousin, right. whatever, grandchild.
And there are ways to put some safeguards in place. For instance, if there are two children mm-hmm. in a family, mm-hmm. one can be helping the parent by writing the checks on that joint account,
mm-hmm.
but the other one might be the recipient of the bank statements.
Sure.
So they can
put some
monitor and work together.
Some
to
oversight
make sure,
into it.
Right,
yep.
some oversight.
But I generally would tell a lot of clients, don't have any joint accounts with your children. Go to the bank with your power of attorney and list them as the power of attorney. The real reason you want the kids to be able to write checks is so that they can help you out if you can't
write
the checks yourself. And that's exactly what a power of attorney does. And now you have some safeguards put in place. So really think hard about your joint accounts. And keep in mind that when an account is joint and you pass away, that person becomes the sole owner of that account. They have no legal requirement to share that account with their siblings, with the people that you say in your will. Your will could say, I want account 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 to be split between my three kids. If you die and that account is joint with one of those kids, that one kid is inheriting it, and they have no legal obligation to share it with their two siblings or whatever the case may be. And in fact, because of the way our gift taxes work, they might actually have a disincentive to even if they wanted to, from the goodness of their heart, make divide it up. They're making a gift to their siblings at that point. It may not make sense. Lauren, I think we have another call. Is that correct? Good morning, Carol. How you doing?
Okay. Good morning. How are you?
I'm very well. Do you have a question for us?
Yes, I do. And it's kind of unusual because I am a senior citizen, and I know that senior citizens don't use iPhones too much or internet, but I do frequent it very often. And my phone is an iPhone, and I get this message from time to time from my bank that says urgent message from, and then the name of the bank regarding your account. Doesn't give me a number, but it gives me a telephone number. Call at once. I didn't recognize the number. I called the regular bank's customer service number. They're telling me it's a fraudulent message. Why is this a possibility? I mean, why do we get these email messages to call our banks intimidating us, and should I be responding to these?
Actually, you shouldn't be responding to them. If you haven't initiated the contact with your bank and you don't expect to get an email from your bank should never be asking you for personal information. The best advice is, if you're on the internet or using email, you may see emails of a similar nature mm-hmm. where you're going to be asked to click on a link. The attempt there is to obtain personal information from you that can be used possibly further down the road, coupled with some other information they may obtain from whatever source, to eventually create a scam that's
sure.
directed specifically to you. We've seen where emails come saying that your ATM card or your credit card's been compromised, and you're supposed to follow the steps to take care of that fraud.
Sure.
But in actuality, it's an attempt to collect personal information.
And
so be very leery. We see similar things with emails and medical scams. Now that the open enrollment period is about to begin, offering bogus medical plans and another attempt to gain personal information.
And I think in a lot of ways you did the right thing in that you, instead of clicking on the link, instead of calling the number in the email, if you have any kind of raised awareness that, wait, this email just tastes a little funny, looks a little strange, let me just call the number that I know is for the
Absolutely.
Bank.
Absolutely.
That's on the back of my ATM card, or that's, on the website or whatever, and ask them about it. You were very smart to do that before clicking on anything. I always want to emphasize to my clients and seniors I know, don't click and then deal with the repercussions. Check first, and then only click if you find out that it is, in fact, safe. And one good point to make here is that we all think about emails today, and even though a lot of seniors don't use the computer, a lot of seniors do. But that a lot of seniors also have smartphones. Those flip phones that everybody likes, the simple ones, I love them, are kind of going the way of the dodo. And those smartphones are computers, so be careful. You could get emails on them too. But one,
that's where I get them, on my
on
phone.
The phone? Okay, perfect.
Yes.
The other thing I want to point out is that there are scams and spam and things that come in now in the form of text messages. And, I've had seniors that I don't know they don't always realize that there's a difference between the email and the text message. They look very similar on the screen of the iPhone or of the Galaxy or whatever the smartphone is. But whatever mode of communication it comes in as, be wary. Always err on the side of not touching it if you have any, or even if you don't have, if you just get a communication, check first. And one benefit you get especially with a bank like Ocean First, is you have that customer service there where you can get a human being on the phone to say whether or not that's a type of email you should open or not, or a link you should click on or next. Great question. Thank you very, very much for listening.
Oh, my pleasure. I listen every the week. So thank you. And I'll be calling you again with another question, I'm sure.
All right. We look forward to it. Thanks.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Once again, you're listening to Inside the Law today on 1160 WOBM. I'm host attorney Jason Wyatt from the law firm Novi & Associates. One thing I want to mention before we wrap up today's show is that if you have any questions or any desire to talk to us or to hear us speak on this or other subjects, please let us know. We have what we call a speakers bureau at our firm where we will offer to come into your community or social group and give a seminar on senior scams or dozens of other topics that are related to our area of practice. And so please do not hesitate to get in touch with us via our website, which is novilaw.com, or our phone number, 732-657-0600. And on the website, novilaw.com, you can click on a number of emails, whichever one makes the most sense. We have a couple of those speaking engagements coming up that I want to make sure I mention. The first is a complimentary breakfast and seminar that we're giving on November 6th at Harrogate Life Care in Lakewood. And the topic is Living with Dignity, Knowledge is Power When Planning for Your Future. And it's about aging in place as well as knowing your options when it comes to continuing care and a lot of the legal ramifications that go into that. It is hosted by Caregiver Volunteers of Central New Jersey, which, by the way, is an incredible nonprofit organization that I encourage everybody to get to know, not only for the possibility that you might find it fulfilling to be a volunteer, but also for the services that they provide, which are ample. And it is being, the guest speakers are Mr. Robert Novi from Novi & Associates, and Lori Flynn from Morgan Stanley in Toms River, where she's a senior vice president of wealth management. So that should be a great topic. Again, that's on November 6th at 8:30 a.m. If you're interested, give us a call at our office number, 732-657-0600, or directly to Caregiver Volunteers of Central New Jersey at 732-505-2273. So the last portion of our show here today, Barbara, I want to talk about what we can do if we have a feeling that somebody is the victim of fraud. What can you do as a banker? What can I do as an attorney? What can my listening public do as a family member or even as a victim themselves? What are some of the steps that you can take?
Well, perhaps we should talk about some of the warning signs that would be there for you as a child or a grandchild of a senior, or as a banker or as an investment counselor or as an attorney.
Sure, the warning signs being the first step to action.
Right. Yeah. So you might observe that there are frequent or large withdrawals that are not common for the individual to be making. Sudden non-sufficient funds activity.
And the bank sees that.
Unpaid bills.
You guys
have
a good...
The bank would see that the bank may all of a sudden see insufficient funds activity for a customer that's never had that situation before.
Right.
So if they've paid out their monies as part of a scam,
mm-hmm.
or they're losing money because somebody is taking it out of their account and they're not aware of it, that can happen. Uncharacteristic attempts to wire large amounts of money. Mm-hmm. is another sign,
mm-hmm.
Being closed mouth about the reason for that, possibly associated with that as well. Closing accounts such as CDs that have penalties and not being concerned about the penalties.
Sure.
establishing a new relationship that's never existed in the past, and showing fear possibly in the company of that individual when they're conducting business or seeing family or friends. So caregivers or other individuals who want to stay very close to the senior or not give them an opportunity to speak may be a sign that something's going on. So it's a very big problem. The American Bankers Association has reported that senior financial abuse has cost seniors about $2.9 billion in the year last year alone.
That's billion with a B,
billion
folks.
With a B,
billion
right.
with a B. Wow.
So, and it's seriously underreported. So there, people are reluctant to report because they feel embarrassed. They don't want to get a loved one in trouble, possibly be sent to jail. They're afraid of reprisal that might happen for the person that's perpetrating
sure.
the crime.
So, especially when it's a family member.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So you're asking what's being done.
What can we do? Right,
so
right.
what we can do as a person who's not a senior, is make sure that when you get things in the mail, that you're shredding statements, if you're getting paper statements, shredding statements and unused credit card offers, carefully choose a trustworthy person to do estate planning for you.
Absolutely.
I can't emphasize that enough. Never give your Social Security number, your account number, or any other personal identifying information via the phone or the internet unless you've initiated that contact.
Mm-hmm.
If somebody's asking or fishing for that information, as we call it, from you, be on the alert for that.
Yep.
If you've got strangers in your house, such as caregivers or repair people, make sure you lock up your checkbook and your account statements and that kind of thing and other sensitive information so they can't get it. Order a copy of your credit report once a year. Don't act on offers that are too good to be true.
That's a big one.
Because
that is a big one.
And especially if someone instructs you not to tell anyone about it.
Yep.
That's a key sign. Some of the offers are worded such that they're obvious
yes.
that they're from not within the country, and you can pick those out. But the last thing is tell someone you trust.
Mm-hmm.
If you feel victimized or threatened, tell someone that you feel you can trust that it's happening. And then report it. If you have been victimized, report it. From a bank perspective, if you see suspect checks or unauthorized withdrawals, contact your bank. Contact local law enforcement.
Yep.
The Federal Trade Commission is another resource at www.ftc.gov.
Mm-hmm.
The Internet Crime Complaint Center, www.ic3.gov. It's a combination organization with the FBI,
right?
The Better Business Bureau is another one. And in terms of identity theft, you can call the FTC at 1-877-ID-THEFT. The credit bureaus, if you want, I can give those numbers over the phone.
Absolutely.
Equifax.
On our website, novilaw.com, a summary of every show. So the numbers that Barbara's reading within the next week or two will also be posted on our website through our blog and the show summary. So if you didn't get a chance to write them down, I'm going to have her continue to read them. I want those resources on the website eventually.
Okay.
So go ahead, Barbara.
So Equifax is 1-800-525-6285.
And they'll give you a credit score.
www.equifax.com.
Mm-hmm.
Experian is 1-888-397-3742. www.experian.com.
Mm-hmm.
TransUnion is the third one, 1-800-680-7289. www.transunion.com. In the case of mail theft or mail fraud, contact the U.S. Postal Inspector. www.postalinspectors.uspis.gov.
Or tell the postmaster at your local post office.
Yes, tell them.
That also works.
And they can get you in touch with the right reporting resource. For investment fraud, report it to the SEC at www.sec.gov. And there are some other really good resources for seniors to use
sure.
to become more informed and aware.
Mm-hmm.
The National Adult Protective Services Association. And the AARP, Smart Money for Older Adults. You can Google these and
post them. And check our website.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barbara. Thank you for all that information that we squeezed in there at the end. Check our website for those links, everybody. Thank you, everybody, for listening today. We had some great callers. It was a great show. Have a wonderful fall day and a great Halloween this Friday. I loved having you on the show. Go Ohio State Buckeyes tonight against my Penn State, against the Penn State Nittany Lions. You stay classy, New Jersey. Thanks for stopping by.
And thank you to all the readers of the Asbury Park Press for voting Ocean First, best of the best for banks in Ocean County for the sixth year in a row. Thank you.
Bye, everybody.
WOBM Lakewood Township.